This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. This is Don Nolan, and this is Keeping the Faith. I'm substituting for Steve Shoemaker this afternoon, and we have a very interesting program for you. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. Wilbur Otto, who is the chairman of the board of the Amish Interpretive Center in Arcola, Illinois. And he is here to talk with us about a very interesting topic, I think you'll find when we get into it. It is the subject of entrepreneurship, Amish entrepreneurship to be exact. And there are some folks in our community who have stereotypes or impressions of the Amish community that might find that puzzling, and you're going to talk to us a little bit about what that means. Welcome to the program, Mr. Otto.
Thank you.
We are a call-in program, and if you would like to talk with Mr. Otto about this topic, you can call in. The local number is 333-9455, and you can also call a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. In addition to talking about Amish entrepreneurship, we also want to talk a little bit about the use of the name Amish, and Mr. Otto is going to talk to us a little bit about that, and he is eminently qualified. So I understand it, your family goes back to the very beginnings of the founding of the Amish community in Douglas County, is that right?
That's correct. The first three Amish families that came in 1865, my great-great-grandfather was one of the three.
And the Interpretive Center, the Amish Interpretive Center, I'm sure many have been to, but as I understand it, it opened in 1996, is that right?
That's correct. Three of us who grew up in the Amish tradition, but who are now in the Mennonite tradition or similar Protestant tradition, determined that there was a need for folks who were visiting the community and were interested in the Amish to go and have a good source of information and possibly even experience parts of the Amish culture directly in a way that was as unobtrusive and as gentle with the Amish lifestyle as it is possible to be when one is a tourist.
Mm. Had there been problems before then?
Well, obviously, the Amish have become kind of an icon over the last 30 and 40 years, and a lot of curiosity about their culture exists. And so increasingly, folks come through the community partly in response to advertising primarily by non-Amish businesses seeking to attract more tourists to the area. And so that interference led partially to our decision. I mean, the most egregious example is in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where tour buses virtually are bumper to bumper going through the community, and families who, you know, would like to send their children on a bicycle to the neighbor's house simply are afraid to do it because of the heavy tourist influx and other kind of traffic problems.
Well, let's just go back a little bit. You mentioned that you grew up Amish, but you're now in the local Mennonite church.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about the relationship between the Mennonite and the Amish and the Anabaptist. Sort that out a little bit. It goes way back to the 1600s, as I understand.
Well, the original founders of the Anabaptist movement are generally attributed to be Felix Mons and Conrad Grebel in 1527. It turns out more recent scholarship has shown that this reaction to the Protestant Reformation that Luther founded in 1519 had many origins, but the generally accepted view is that the first baptism of adults, which was one of the prime sticking points between Luther and the Anabaptists, happened in 1527 in Switzerland. And so that movement gained quite a few adherents within Switzerland and then spread into southern Germany and into eastern France and in
just,
Holland.
Just to be specific, Luther's view of baptism was?
Luther's view of baptism was that a child, an infant, should be baptized within the church.
The Catholic Church's tradition.
Which was also the Catholic Church's tradition, and Luther's Reformation affected other parts of the theology, but not the infant baptism. Mm-hmm. The Amish, the Anabaptists, emphasized the separation of church and state, and that baptizing the child in as a member of the church also meant they were a citizen of the state. And the Anabaptists felt that one needed to be guarded about one's involvement with the state. So this baptism affected that also.
And Jacob Ammon came along and split.
1693, he felt that the original Anabaptist movement from 170 years before in 1527 had grown lax in their discipline. And so he established a group of fellow ministers who placed their larger Anabaptist ministers in the ban and refused to fellowship with them because they felt they had not followed the original Anabaptist teaching in terms of plainness of dress, honesty in dealings, and so forth. Ironically, Ammon later regretted the rashness of their move and placed himself in the ban for having made such a drastic move in 1693, but by that time, which I think was within 2 years, the feelings had been exacerbated between the two factions, and so they never really reconciled.
There were also persecutions by the Catholic Church of the Anabaptist and the Amish in particular, is that right?
That is true, and it wasn't just the Catholic Church, it was the Protestant mm-hmm. Church as well. There was a reform movement in Switzerland that a fellow named Zwingli started. And he had a number of them burned at the stake, executed, drowned in the rivers, and so forth. And that led to a kind of a dispersion of the original Swiss movement into Germany. My Otto ancestors came from the area in Waldeck, Germany, immigrated in 1819, and we believe that they had moved up there sometime in the 1750s or 60s from the Bern area of Switzerland.
So you can trace your lineage? Do you have a lineage that you can trace?
Mm-hmm. There are many families within the Arthur Amish community that mm-hmm. can trace their lineage back to the ones who were persecuted and killed in Switzerland. The Graeber family, for example, is a prominent name within Arthur, and the progenitor of that family, Graeber, was taken to prison, I think, in 1580. He was 71 years old. He was fastened in irons, and he was hauled in front of the clerics in the Emmental region of Switzerland, and I'm quoting here. He was asked to explain why he was proselytizing, and he lit into the clerics and, quote, accusing them of lying, deceiving, seducing, suppressing, and tearing like wolves, robbing, murdering, butchering, and oppressing in order to seduce people and subjects in bodies, effects, and soul. And this was contrary to his understanding of the Bible. So you can see he didn't hold back much, and it was pretty easy for the critics of the Anabaptists to consider them radicals and extremists and to fear them.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, your family, I assume, moved to Pennsylvania?
Yeah, the immigrant Ottos in 1830 came from Germany to in western Pennsylvania in the area around Grantsville, Maryland, and just outside Pittsburgh, southeast of Pittsburgh, about 90 miles.
And eventually to Indiana, Illinois.
And in 1865, we speculate it was a result of the Civil War, they came in 1864, in the summer of 64, right after the Battle of Gettysburg. And my grandfather recalls his grandfather talking, no, I'm sorry, it was his father, talking about as a child in 1860 having to go out in the fields and chase the horses to keep them nervous and agitated because the soldiers were coming through and conscripting the horses. And from that and other little bits of information, I think they were just tired of the war having gone on around them for 4 years and decided to come west and find a safer place.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they wouldn't take sides with either the Confederacy or the Union put them in a very uncomfortable place.
Well, the Amish have been there since 1865, and how has that community grown since then? I assume that the population has increased steadily, but not exponentially. I saw a figure somewhere that in North America there's somewhere around 220,000 plus.
It's true. I mean, I believe at the turn of the century, someone has cited about 5,000 Amish religionists. But now the citation is that they double every 20 years. And the joke among the Amish is that what will the population of the Amish be by some figure, maybe 2100? Well, all of the United States will be Amish except for the taxi drivers.
Well, if they have taxi drivers.
Yeah.
Well, how did you evolve in your own biography to become a Mennonite? And what is the difference between the Mennonite and the Amish tradition?
Well, again, the original Anabaptist movement became known as the Mennonites after a leader in Holland whose name was Menno Simons. And the Amish arrived in North America sometime around the early 1700s. There were already some Mennonite communities here, but what I find interesting is that they did not commingle and tried not to settle in the same areas. That's odd to me because in my background in Arthur, Illinois, the Amish and the Mennonites are very cooperative towards each other, have a mutual friendship. But that is because in this community, the Mennonites began by a reform movement within the Old Order Amish in 1937, and they felt the Amish were now too lax in their religion and not pietistic enough. And so in 1937, the Mennonite Church was organized from Amish folks. So they kind of, you know, progress mutation by mutation.
Mm. Now, there are Amish Mennonites. There's New Order Amish and apparently Old Order Amish in the country today. Does that cover the landscape?
Well, actually, I think there are at least 20 permutations of Amish by now because there is a tendency, as there is among most Protestant denominations, to have factions and splits. And some
they do tend to argue more.
They do tend to argue. So within the Douglas County Amish Mennonite hierarchy or aggregate, you find the original Amish, Old Order of Amish, actually was not a term that was used until about 1890 or 1900. Mm. The Platt book from 1875 of Douglas County refers to our new neighbors in the southeast part of the of Douglas County who call themselves Amish Mennonites. And in fact, that is what we now call Old Order Amish actually called themselves prior to 1890. At about 1890, in the turn of the century, there became a suspicion of much of the new technology that was advancing upon them, and the more change-minded, progressive Amish Mennonites wanted to adopt all of it. And the Old Order segment said, well, this is dangerous, and this will change our culture and our family life. And so they started insisting on the Old Order. That phrase became known in the Arthur community in general, followed the Old Order segment of the broader Amish Mennonite tradition within the United States.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. Now, our specific topic, why don't we just go ahead and touch on, relates to this question of technology, I think, in interesting ways. Perhaps most people who have heard of the Amish or have gone down to visit do obviously note the what seems to many people to be a rejection of technology, but then, of course, that's not true at all. So the interesting question, isn't it, what are the criteria for rejecting, and how does that relate to entrepreneurship? The Amish, as I understand it, there's an organizational structure with bishops, and you have meetings where this question is discussed. And as I understand it, the issue is, does technology drive the community or does the community drive technology? You want to address that as a background question about entrepreneurship?
Well, you pretty aptly summarized it. I mean, that is the process when a new use of technology is advocated within the community. Congregational meeting is held, and interestingly, the bishop does not vote in this meeting. My grandfather was an Amish bishop and used to joke about how everyone attributes the bishop to being kind of a dictator, and the bishop certainly does have a lot of influence, and folks are reluctant to openly contradict his teaching. But
the bishop doesn't have the last say?
But the bishop does not have the last say. It's a congregational decision. Hmm. And in fact, a change requires a 100% consensus. And so
of
the congregation.
And that includes?
And so the bishop presides, but he isn't somebody, you know, that is voting. And so that is why change comes slowly, because it does require 100% consensus. But what is remarkable within this community is, as the need to develop other sources of livelihood other than farming became more apparent, there was a meeting of all of the ministers within the Arthur community in 1967, and they discussed the problem of many of their young men not having employment except for going to work for outside folks whom they call the English because they speak English, and they preferred for them to have, you know, more opportunities within their brotherhood. And so it was decided.
Originally, the early communities were mostly German.
Exactly.
Dialect, right?
And so and in Arthur, Illinois, that marks a time when you saw kind of a flowering of small cottage industries on the farm, because there was a consensus that that needed to be encouraged. There were several prominent Arthur entrepreneurs who had Amish roots. One was a Schrock fellow who started manufacturing kitchen cabinets, and that factory grew quite large. Now I think is around 700 employees, and it actually been sold several times to investment funds and larger corporations.
But, oh, really?
But Schrock, as part of his concept, invited Amish individuals on their farms to produce cabinets under contract for him. And eventually these contractors started taking outside work, and that is a genesis of the cabinet-making industry and even furniture-making industry within the Arthur Amish community.
Now, how do you handle profit in a cabinet-making, particular cabinet-making industry? I assume that there isn't opposition to creating profit by introducing different technologies, but what are the criteria for limiting that, or are there?
Well, among about 6 points that I made that are distinctions between an Amish way of looking at business and general society, one of them is that the use of a modern adaptation of equipment has to be approved within the congregation. In terms of profit, there's no restriction on that. And in fact, many of the Amish businesses now will have a retirement plan or a profit-sharing plan of some form, so the employees, when they retire, will continue to receive some income. Because they do not contribute to the Social Security system, that's a pretty big deal.
Is that a requirement?
Pardon?
Is that a requirement?
Well, I would not say it's a requirement. It's discouraged, but I personally know that a number of the Amish who have no other resources now are drawing on Social Security, but they received an exemption from the Social Security Administration in terms of not having to contribute to it because of their tradition of taking care of their own, the poor among them. Mm-hmm. They will take care of them. And, of course, their English competitors say, well, that's no fair. They don't have an expense burden that we do, and when they're competing with us on a job, that gives them an unfair advantage. In general, I think they compete based on the quality of their work and, to some extent, price, but that is a distinction between an Amish business and a general business.
Let's talk about this a little bit more, just to remind our listening audience, if you're interested in talking to Mr. Wilbur Otto, who is with us today from the Amish Interpretive Center in Arcola to talk about Amish entrepreneurship and the use of the name Amish in commercial society today, you can call in. Local number is 333-9455. You can also call a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. What would an obscene profit be?
I think they just don't think in terms of that. They think in terms of what is a fair price. And if I happen to buy a closeout stock of lumber because someone's going out of business and I can use that to make more than my normal profit, I ought to. And that's how they look at it. What prompted my discussion with Steve Shoemaker when he called to ask me to be on this program was that I had just watched the delightful skewering of Kramer on the Daily Show. Jon Stewart took his head off for the flagrant, amoral, atavistic abuses of the financial system by the Wall Street folks who knew they were taking money from the 401k plans and enriching themselves. Mm-hmm. And I was telling Steve, that's, you will never find an Amishman on Wall Street because that isn't the way he thinks. Now, the obscene profit question that you ask that wouldn't even be a question on Wall Street. There is no such thing as an obscene profit on Wall Street.
Tell me again, why wouldn't you see someone, an Amish stock trader?
Several reasons. I mean, obviously, they discourage higher education, and it takes a certain financial knowledge to be in that business. Secondly, they discourage partnerships or linkages with outside businesses. They mm-hmm. they want folks to support each other in their own businesses. Thirdly, you really are dependent on the use of modern technology and the financial field.
Computers, telephones,
absolutely. You won't find a laptop, in an Amish business. In fact, it was quite a concession, and that began after the ministers' meeting in 1967 when they decided they would allow telephones to be used by the Amish on their farm so long as they were kept in a separate building out at the edge of the road. But they recognized that a businessman needs to be able to contact his clients and clients contact him.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a call on line one. Before we go to that caller, just very, very briefly, what's the problem with those technologies that you just mentioned? Why are they constrained?
Well, the overarching question is, what is the effect on our families and on our culture and on our religious life? And the decision not to have electrical appliances of any kind or radios or television was because it will have a drastic effect on the family life and the home life. The Amish entertainment is to go visit their neighbors, and they do that three or four times. It builds community, not destroys it, and much of the media does destroy it.
We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your question, comment?
Are you talking about me?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
You're on.
Okay, I have two questions. First of all, I've read all the novels of Beverly Lewis. She's an Amish writer. She's wonderful. Do you all have services in German?
Let me answer both questions. Beverly Lewis writes about the Amish. I see her novels, and she's a delightful writer. And she gives a fairly accurate portrayal, although as someone who grew up in the Amish, I find myself reading it and thinking, oops, that's not quite right. And I recognize that when you're not within a culture, it's really hard to write 100% all of the nuances. The second thing is, The Amish do hold their services in German, although there tends to be more of a tendency now if there is a funeral service in which neighbors and non-Amish speakers are there. They will include some English scriptures and make some portions of the service understandable to an English visitor.
Do you have a second question? I think the caller's gone. We have another caller on line 4. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your question or comment?
Thank you. Very interesting. I once did similar kind of work to what you did in Ontario many years ago when I got out of seminary, and I became concerned. This was among the Old Order Mennonites in around Kitchener, Ontario, in Elmira. And I became concerned that I thought there was some exploitation of the Old Order Mennonites who are similar to Amish. They're not exactly the same, but they're to many outside of the community they are, of industries developing around them and tour buses kind of invading their privacy. And I know you mentioned Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and I know in Ohio, I believe Holmes County, there's an extensive tourist industry about around the Amish. Do you have any more comments on that subject?
Yeah, I do, and that is precisely why I devoted the energy and the resources to get something going, because I could see that it's going to happen in terms of tourism developing within the community, and so it was important to me to challenge it in a way that was constructive. The distinction we make is we have gawkers and we have seekers. And the gawkers are the ones that will come with their camera, put it right in the face of an Amish person on a street, and take his picture and are heedless of their reluctance to be photographed. Seekers are the ones that will come to the interpretive center and have direct contact with an Amish family by having a meal in a home with them or by touring an Amish farm, by a farm that has agreed to provide that service. And so we kind of channel it and control it in a way that gives outlet to the curiosity that folks genuinely feel. Mm.
Mm. Thank you for your call. We have another call on line 1. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Well, hello. I appreciate this opportunity. I have two different questions, one economic and one educational. Let me start with the educational one, because all I want to know is I thought there was a college near Goshen that was maybe a seminary or for Amish or Mennonite. Is that correct?
Indeed, there is a Goshen College, and it was formed actually in, I believe, 1910 by the Amish Mennonite conferences. And at that time, they still called themselves Amish Mennonites. Now, subsequently, as the Old Order movement kind of gathered strength, it was agreed that really it should be called a Mennonite college, and they took the Amish part of it off. But there, you won't find a lot of Amish folks there. If they are there, they are marginal or fringe Amish, and are probably on the way to leaving the Amish belief.
Mm. I see. The economic question is, I understand that there is cost of land pressure for among the Amish community the expansion of farmland is certainly not not an easy thing as far as the Amish lifestyle is concerned, and the division of farmland among family is certainly a problem. How is that being handled these days?
Well, it is an enormous issue when you have now the average family probably is 4 or 5, but in my parents' generation, the family size was 9 to 14, and that required a lot of homesteads as these young people became adults. And they're just part of it is by an outward expansion. Part of the land pressure is released by starting new settlements. There are now around 16 Amish settlements within Illinois. And when we started the Interpretive Center in 96, we were the only Amish settlement. And so that is part of the release of the land pressure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your call. We have another call on line 2. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes. wondered if Amish still practice shunning. Beverly Lewis wrote about that in one of her books.
Indeed, they do. And, you know, within my extended family, some of whom are Amish, it is known that if someone has a moral lapse or a violation of one of the church ordinances, their first is, you know, a visit to encourage returning to the accepted practice, and, you know, a protracted period of teaching and remonstration occurs. But in the end, if the member persists, he is placed in the ban. And while he is in the ban, it is not permissible to A, do business with him, B, eat with them, or socialize with them. Now, this makes uncomfortable situation when there's a death in the family or some event. In my family, when my parents chose to leave the Amish, the fact that they were joining a sister church, the Mennonite church, meant that the punishment would be fairly light. But they were briefly placed in the ban. And what I remember is grandfather placing two tables end to end, separate tablecloths, separate serving dishes. But we sat at one table, and the rest of the family sat in the other table, and we all sat together and ate together. So we technically, he kept the ban, but in fellowship, you know, there was no distinction. And then within, I think, a six-week period, you know, the church met and decided to remove my parents from the ban. And in many instances, I have seen Amish husbands who left the family, placed in the ban, and after some period of time, realizing that that wasn't the track they wanted to be on, and come back to their family. And so there are abuses, you know, undoubtedly, that happen in which the ban is administered in a hurtful and a hateful way, and breaches within family and society are made that are never healed. But there are generally success stories in that the folks arrive at some reconciliation as a part of the ban.
Did that answer your question? Okay, thank you. We have a caller on line four. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. In my endeavors, I work with wood a lot. I own a business in that area. I run into people of Amish folks a lot, in a lot of different places, a lot of different situations, where they will be at organizations where you learn more about wood and stuff like that. And also, I go to Arthur every now and again to the thing down there, the auto center. And the question I have with you is that I'm not sure I completely understand some of the logic. Many times you'll have taxi drivers to drive you from here to there, so you don't drive an automobile. And many times you'll purchase equipment that is electrically driven, but you'll take the electric motors off and then put air motors or hydraulic motors on it to use the same equipment but not using the electricity. It seems to me kind of strange you say you don't do these things, but yet, like you say, you find an accommodation around it. I'm not sure I totally understand that.
Well, certainly, to someone who looks at that on the surface, it just looks ridiculous. You know, if you don't believe you should own a car, then why are you so free to pay someone else who does own a car? Well, the reason is they don't consider the ownership of the car a moral issue. The issue for them is, what is the effect if everyone has a car? And that answer is fairly simple. You pretty quickly are assimilated into general culture and all of the problems that come with that. With the electricity, you know, the phrase they use is getting electricity from the pole, meaning there is a power line coming from the electrical grid into the center of the farmyard, and there's a pole there with a meter on it. But they do not allow that, but a lot of folks have solar panels and electrically powered things. Again, it's a way to control the kind of change. Now, that electrical drill that you alluded to, they don't see that as a moral issue at all, but they just see a much better way to handle the assimilation issue is by having a little gasoline-powered generator that they plug their electric nail gun into on the job, and they use it, and when they're done, they turn it off, and they're not part of the power grid and all of the problems that might follow the power grid into their home.
I see. So the problem is not with the power. It's pretty much being with everybody else.
It's the effect that you have within the home once you introduce that bit of technology into it. I remember talking to an anthropologist a number of years ago, and we were talking about cultures, you know, primitive cultures in New Guinea or someplace, and how to be the least obtrusive while at the same time offering some of the benefits of modern technology with them. And what he said is the problem is you can't bring technology without bringing all the problems of modern civilization with it. And you just have this trade-off that the Amish are constantly measuring. See, is the trade-off worth the effect?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. We'll talk a little bit more about that. What does the English community outside of the Amish community, as it's referred to, do you think have to learn from the Amish about the use of technology? I'm thinking most recently I was just listening to Bill Moyers the other night complain about Twitter. He could not figure out what possible relevance going on in Twittering and tweeting would have. And he says he hasn't done it and won't do it. And it does occur to me that there's something about the capacity to communicate so instantly and perhaps even in shallow terms that undermines community.
Exactly. They see that constant Twitter. I'm putting words in their mouth. I'm not sure there are too many Amish that are even familiar with Twitter.
Right.
But the effect certainly would be to interfere with the normal kind of face-to-face personal communication that is the basis for the best kind of social relationships. And so, the use of the computer for email, the use of the telephone at one point was prohibited or at least restrained, although now an interesting side effect is that the cell phone has become ubiquitous among many Amish communities. And so it's no longer, out at the end of the lane by the road. It's a cell phone in their pocket. Now, they're supposed to, have a gentleman's agreement to only use it for business, but there's a pretty general disregard of that, and social calls will be made on it. And that will change Amish culture, which is part of what I intended to emphasize, is that the culture is changing. And what we have developed as kind of the iconic old order Amish lifestyle is probably disappearing, or at least is changing with increasing velocity. That has to do with the use of the English language in all of their daily communication. And so now at home, it's used more and more. And within social structures, generally when a culture loses its primary language, then it loses many other important cultural elements.
Regarding the phone, I did come across some quote from a bishop that said, "The telephone makes gossip too easy. They were too handy and were worldly."
That's true. And when the phones first came out, they were introduced in the Amish homes in around 1912 in Lancaster, at least. And eventually they saw the effect and they decided after the fact, this isn't good, and they got to come out. So then the same thing, there were Amish folks that had automobiles in the early 1900s.
Right.
And then they were prohibited.
We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Yes, I have a question. And this just shows how little I know, but I have seen people walking around Champaign-Urbana wearing a different type of clothing. I have been down to Arthur, so I've seen the horse and buggies and all, but I was surprised recently when I went to Marketplace Mall and I saw women wearing bonnets and sort of long dresses, and I don't know if they were Amish or Mennonite, but they were shopping in the mall, and I was just very surprised. because this just contributes to, you know, my own not understanding the culture very well. But could you speak a little bit, not so much about the clothing, but just about the extent to which the Amish in the Arthur area come up to Champaign-Urbana and interact in the stores? I've seen them in grocery stores. I've seen them in the malls. I've seen them. One time my daughter and I were sitting in a local fast food place, and this bunch of men came in, and I guess they had been working on a house someplace, and they were eating hamburgers. And I was just sort of surprised. That's my question.
Thank you very much.
Well, I would say in general they have accommodated themselves to, you know, fast food establishments and shopping in the large malls and so on. Even though they make most of their own clothing, there are some essential utilities that they will buy. You probably won't see them in the jewelry store because they prohibit the use of jewelry. I brought along a quotation, actually, about how the Amish dress from 400 years ago by the Swiss authorities who were in exasperated tones describing the Anabaptists. It says, "Expensive clothes they disdain. They refrain from expensive food and drink," explains McDonald's. "They dress in coarse material and cover their heads with wide-rimmed felt hats. Their walk and way is marked by modesty. They carry no weapons, neither sword nor dagger, only a short bread knife. All other things are the clothes of wolves, which should not be worn by the sheep. They swear not at all and do not pay their government the oath of citizens. If anyone trespasses therein, they ban him from their midst. This they do daily." And that was while they were described 400 years ago, before the advent of McDonald's and marketplace malls.
Mm. Well, we have approximately 15 minutes left. And if you would like to call in to talk with Mr. Wilbur Otto about the Amish, and we're going to move shortly here to the topic that you came to talk about, that's Amish entrepreneurship and the use and abuse of the name Amish. You can call in at 333-9455. That's a local number. Or you can also call toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, tell us a little bit about the difference. You mentioned earlier that Amish do business differently than the English meaning the outside world, outside of the Amish community. Tell us a little bit more about how to understand Amish entrepreneurship, and how is that being abused, in particular the name Amish? I just saw a commercial a couple of weeks ago about some electric fireplace bragging that this is Amish made, and I guess my eyebrows went up when I saw that.
Well, your eyebrows went up rightly, and that was one of the ads that I alluded to when I agreed to be on this program, because it's an outrageous abuse of the Amish name and a simple, straightforward attempt to steal from their religion in order to make a profit. The first place, no Amishman who advertises his business will advertise his religion with his business. They're very specific. They say, we will not make money off of our religion. So if you see an ad and it has Amish in it, you almost certainly are not dealing with an Amishman. Secondly, these fireplaces are a Chinese import brought in by a huckster from Cleveland who has been before the Better Business Bureau a number of times, and his inspiration was to have a little wooden wrap around it produced by some folks in Ohio whose photograph he has in his ad, who ipso facto are not old order Amish if they are being photographed. Now, they are a variant of the Amish. Their origins are with the Amish, but it is incorrect to call them Amish. And irregardless of the facts, that's what he puts in his ad, and that's why it's so offensive.
Mm. Let's come back to that. We have several callers. Line one, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I hope this is relevant to your discussion, but I'm married to a woman who is from another Anabaptist group, the Hutterites. And they they are very, in my understanding, they're very related in terms of religion to the Amish, and yet they live very differently. And I wondered if your guest had any comments on the differences or similarities of the Hutterites to the Amish.
It's interesting. When we organized the Illinois Amish Interpretive Center in Arcola, one of our objectives was to allow the Seekers and, I guess, the Gawkers also to have a place to come to learn about the Amish. But the second one was to help also educate the broader Amish community about their Anabaptist origins and to help preserve some of the material culture of the original Amish farms and settlers, and then also to make connections with co-religionists that they would feel some kinship with. And so we brought some of the Hutterites from North Dakota in a symposium 3 years ago, you know, it was a wonderful meeting. They discovered they sing the same songs, although the Hutterites tend to use a different form of German than the Amish dialect. They discovered that they deal with the same issues in terms of how to keep their young folks within the faith. It was very interesting to hear the Hutterites, who own all goods in community. Each colony is the purest communist model that has yet been invented, in that all work for the good of each other, and when anyone has need, it's taken care of from the common purse. And so they have chosen to adopt modern technology. All of their homes are electrified. They have state-of-the-art shops on their huge farms in which they overhaul tractors and combines and the most modern equipment. They send their young folk, they have just started sending their young folks to college to get technical training in order how to operate, you know, the equipment. But for the most part, 80 to 85% of their young folks come back from this exposure to the outside culture and come back into the Hutterite tradition. What they have told me is anyone can come back after he leaves the Hutterite tradition. They are welcome if they are 75 years old and come back. Now, the Hutterites have the same problem that the Amish and that all of us have, in that there are egregious moral lapses that, you know, can certainly be sensationalized and trivialized by the news. When we organized the Interpretive Center, we went to see some of the Amish leadership to explain to them that this was a not-for-profit enterprise. We weren't going to make money on it. We simply wanted to do a better job explaining what the culture and the faith was about. And one of the bishops in distress said, "But don't you understand? We're just people. We're just like everyone else. We just want to be left alone." And I said, "Our job is to explain that you are just people, and that when there are lapses, that doesn't mean that the whole structure of your theology is condemned. It just means there are lapses." And so he became a supporter of what we were doing. But I think we've wandered off of your question.
Thank you for the call. We have another call on line 4, I believe. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Did you say line 4?
Line 4. Yes,
hi,
ma'am. You're on.
I'm calling from Terre Haute.
Mm-hmm.
And where my family has had contact with the Amish are places like the Indianapolis Zoo and also Turkey Run State Park, the swimming pool. And we have a couple kids, and my daughter asks lots of questions about Amish when we see them, and especially when we were at the pool at Turkey Run, there were buses, big tour buses of Amish families, mostly young people. And in the swimming pool, the boys and the young men were swimming, and the girls and the young women, none of them were swimming. But they were there, and they were just waiting. And they were waiting and waiting and waiting for hours just in front of the pool. And there was one little girl who's about my daughter's age, and she kept coming over to dip her toes in the pool. And that was a really hard thing for me to explain to my daughter, why how the world can be fair if a little girl can't go swimming on a really hot summer day and just has to watch her brothers. So can you help me explain, daughter, and I'm going to hang up the phone, and you can explain it.
Thank you for your call.
Well, I certainly would say that it seems on the surface to be a real injustice that the boys can wear what they would term a rather immodest garment of swim trunks and the girls cannot. But that's just how they view it. That's where they draw the line. The amusing story within our family is going to the seashore. They went to Lancaster to visit Amish relatives, and they, decided to take a trip to the beach. And one of the distinctions between the Amish and the English is that when they accumulate surplus money, have profits, the way they spend it is quite different. And so you are allowed family tours to see scenic nature and so on. To go to Disney World isn't as acceptable, although it's done somewhat. But certainly family trips to see God's creation is considered acceptable. So you'll see them at Turkey Run, not so often in the swimming pool. In the beach incident, the venerable lady who was too modest to put on a swimming trunk was wading in the ocean, and then a wave came and knocked her end over appetite, as my dad would say, and she found herself in a quite immodest position when the wave receded. But, you know, she still would not wear a swim outfit. Those are just anomalies that, you know, they accept. And what I will say is growing up until the age of 10, my family was Amish. Sunday afternoon, boys went swimming in the river, and the girls went someplace else and went swimming in the river, and it was understood, you know, gentlemen's agreement, you didn't go there. That's the compromise.
And at the opposite end of the extreme, the English seem to have some problems with sexualizing young girls with advertisements and the media. So we all share the foibles of being human. Mm-hmm. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate your program. I had a pair of questions related to the role of women in the community, both as it relates to the decision-making process you mentioned earlier, where there is a consensus among the community when decisions are to be made, and also the role of women in running businesses or in the entrepreneurship you've mentioned. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Yes. That's a very interesting question, and they are essentially a conservative, patronomic society. The men are assumed to be the leaders in the home and in the church. The voice of women are taken in church decisions. In my business, in which I deal with many of the Amish, and I'm a real estate broker, I always find the men sitting down with their wife or bringing their wife in to make financial decisions. They by and large work by consensus within, you know, the two parent, the married couple role. You do find a number of single women who have established businesses on their own, garden supply outlets, fabric and household supply businesses, quite large and sophisticated businesses are operated by women. There is no prohibition against the women earning a living in that way.
Mm. Now, you, as you say, you're a real estate broker and you have other business interest, and you are in the local Mennonite tradition, and you mentioned the Hutterites in South Dakota who are more strictly communal.
Yeah.
Are the Amish in Arcola, the old Amish, in between those two? And just from a personal point of view, where do you see yourself in your business activities on that spectrum?
I probably am a fairly assimilated American businessman, probably more assimilated than I should be. Within the Arthur Amish, you know, farms and business assets are owned individually. However, there is a strong self-help modus, and so if a barn is burned, they get together and rebuild it. If there's a medical need, they have a benefit and raise the money to pay for it. Many of the principles of sharing of goods are held. If an Amish person or businessman gets in financial trouble and is perceived not to be meeting his obligations adequately, a committee from the church will be appointed to help him take care of his affairs, and they will take his checkbook, and all of his income is delivered to them, and they make the disbursement and get him back on his feet. And to take bankruptcy as a way to escape an obligation is a basis for being put out of the church.
Is that right?
That's right. And so
legal bankruptcy is a basis.
Absolutely. And an example of an Amishman who suffered a severe loss, a huge economic loss that was caused by English. He lamented, you know, he had obligations that he knew he couldn't pay. But he also knew if he took bankruptcy to settle them, he would be put out of the church. And his bank agreed to loan him the money to continue an operation till he could get going. And, of course, his story of how great God is was that God helped me thrive in business so I could pay off all these obligations.
I take it that they have no credit card debt.
They use credit cards. Yes, they do.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They have savings account. They have credit cards. They have debit cards. They are generally discouraged from investing in Wall Street stocks, although I think now that is not as severely enforced, and many of them, as part of their employee retirement fund, have had to resort to some plans like that.
What about the accumulation of wealth? What limits are there among the old Amish?
They are discouraged from allowing the business, and that's a big distinction between an English-owned or general American society,
right,
where bigger is better. Once you get up to 15 employees, you're encouraged to turn additional business over to a young businessman getting started and help someone else. Although it's quite common to see an Amish businessman help one of his key employees get his own business started and help him set up and refer business there.
There's probably, how shall we put it, a giant sucking sound toward the English in this regard, because I don't know how the recent crash is affected, but is that one of your concerns?
Well, obviously it has not affected the Arthur Amish nearly as severely as it has folks whose 401ks became 201ks. But actually, the home building crisis affects them because so many other industries are related to that.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, in northern Indiana, for example, where many of them work in businesses related to the recreational vehicle industry, there they are suffering financially.
Very, very briefly, 10 to 15 seconds. Did we cover the ball front on the use of the word Amish?
Well, I think so. You know, what I have cautioned the listener on is that if you see the name Amish in the ad, beware that it may not be an Amish-owned business. On the other hand, our Illinois Amish Interpretive Center is a model of a business that is there hopefully to help inform folks about the Amish.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wilbur Otto has been with us today. He's chairman of the board of the Amish Interpretive Center in Arcola. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been watching Keeping the Faith. Thanks for being with us. Good evening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.